seemed the greater risk. This would be just like going outside, she reminded herself, which she had already done and had survived. Except this was safer. She was taking an unlimited supply of air, and there was nothing toxic down there, nothing to eat away at her. She gazed at her reflection in the still water, the bulky suit making her look enormous. If Lucas were standing there with her, if he could see what she was about to do, would he try to talk her out of it? She thought he might. How well did they really know each other? They had, what, 2, 3 encounters in person? But then there were the dozens of talks since. Could she know someone from just his voice? From stories about his childhood? From his intoxicating laughter when everything else in her day made her want to cry? Was this why wires and emails were made expensive, to prevent this kind of life, this kind of relationship? How could she be standing there, thinking of a man she hardly knew, rather than the insanity of the task before her? Maybe Lucas had become her lifeline, some slender thread of hope connecting her to home. Or was he more like a tiny spot of light seen occasionally through the murk, a beacon guiding her return?
Helmet?
Solo stood beside her, watching her, the clear plastic dome in his hands, a single flashlight strapped to its top. Juliet reached for it. She made sure the flashlight was securely fastened and tried to clear her head of pointless ruminations.
Hook up my air first, she said, and turn on the radio.
He nodded. He held the dome while he clicked the air hose into the adapter she'd threaded through the collar. There was a hiss and spit of residual air from the line as it locked into place. His hand brushed the back of her neck as he reached in to flick on the radio. Juliet dipped her chin, squeezing the handmade switch sewn into her undersuit. "Hello, hello," she said. There was a strange squeal from the unit on Solo's hip as her voice blared out of it.
"It's a little loud," he said, adjusting his volume.
She lifted the dome into place. It had been stripped of its screen and all the plastic linings. Once she'd scraped the paint off the exterior, she was left with an almost completely transparent half-sphere of tough plastic. It felt good to know, clicking it into the collar, that whatever she saw out of it was really there.
"You good?"
Solo's voice was deadened by the airtight connection between the helmet and the suit. She lifted her glove and gave him a thumbs up. She pointed to the compressor. He nodded, knelt down by the unit, and scratched his beard. She watched him flick the portable unit's main power, push the priming bulb 5 times, then yank the starting cord. The little unit spat out a breath of smoke and whirred to life. Even with its rubber tires, it danced and rattled the landing, sending vibrations up through her boots. Juliet could hear the awful acoustics through her helmet, could imagine the violent racket echoing up through the abandoned silo. Solo held the choke an extra second, just like she'd shown him, and then pushed it all the way in. While the machine pattered and chugged, he looked up at her, smiling through his beard, looking like one of the dogs in supply staring up at its faithful owner. She pointed to the red can of extra gas and gave him another thumbs up. He returned the gesture. Juliet shuffled toward the steps, her gloved hand on the railing for balance. Solo squeezed past and went to the railing and the knotted rope. He held out a hand to steady her while she lumbered down the slippery treads in the suit's clunky boots. Her hope was that it would be easier to move once she was in the water, but she had no way of knowing, just an intuitive feel for the physics of it all, the way she could gauge a machine's intent simply by poring over it. She took the last dry steps, and then her boots broke the oily surface of the water and found the step below. She waded down 2 more, anticipating the frigid cold to seep through, but it never came. The suit and her undergarments kept her toasty.
Almost too warm, in fact. She could see a humid mist forming over the inside of her helmet. She dipped her chin into the radio switch and told Solo to open her valve to let the air in. He fumbled at her collar and twisted the lever to allow the flow of air. It hissed by her ear, quite noisily, and she could feel the suit puff out around her. The overflow valve she'd screwed into the other side of the collar squealed as it opened and let out the excess pressure, preventing her suit, and her head, she suspected, from bursting.
"Wait,"
she said, clicking on the radio. He ran back to the landing and returned with the round exercise weights. Kneeling on the last dry step, he strapped these below her knees with heavy Velcro, then looked up to see what was next. Juliet struggled to lift one foot, then the other, making sure that the weights were secure.
"Wire,"
she said, getting the hang of working the radio. This was the most important part. The power from IT would run the lifeless pumps below. 24 volts of juice. She had installed a switch on the landing so Solo could test it while she was down there. She didn't want to travel with the wires live. Solo unspooled a dozen feet of the two-connector wire and tied a loop around her wrist. His knots were good, both with the rope and the wire. Her confidence in the endeavor was growing by the minute, her discomfort in the suit lessening. Solo smiled down through her clear plastic dome from two steps above, yellow teeth flashing in his scraggly beard. Juliet returned the smile. She stood still while he fumbled with the flashlight strapped to her helmet, clicking it on. The battery was freshly charged and would last a full day, much longer than she possibly needed.
"Okay,"
she said.
"Help me over."
Releasing the radio contact with her chin, she turned and leaned against the railing, worked her belly up onto it, then eased her head over. It was an incredible sensation, throwing herself over that rail. It felt suicidal. This was the great stairwell. This was her silo. She was four levels up from mechanical. All that space below her, that long plummet only madmen dove into, and she was going just as willingly. Solo helped with her weighted feet. He splashed down onto the first wet step to assist her. Juliet threw her leg over the railing as he lifted. Suddenly, she was straddling that narrow bar of slippery steel, wondering if the water would truly hold her, if it would catch and slow her fall. And there was a moment of raw panic, the taste of metal in her mouth, the sinking of her stomach and the dire need to urinate, all while Solo heaved her other foot over the railing, her gloved hands clawing madly for the rope he'd tied, her boots splashing noisily and violently into the silvery skin of the flooded waters.
"Shit!"
She blew her breath out into the helmet, gasping from the shock of splashing in so quickly, her hands and knees wrapping around the twisted rope, her body moving inside the puffy suit like a layer of too large skin had become detached.
"You okay?"
Solo shouted, his hands cupped around his beard. She nodded, her helmet unmoving. She could feel the tug of the weights on her shins, trying to drag her down. There were a dozen things she wanted to say to Solo, reminders and tips, words of luck, but her mind was racing too fast to think of using the radio. Instead, she loosened her grip with her gloves and knees, felt the rope slide against her body with a distant squeak, and she began her long plummet down.
11. Silo 18. Lucas sat at the little desk, constructed from an embarrassment of wood, and stared down at a book stuffed with a fortune in crisp paper. The chair beneath him was probably worth more than he'd make in a lifetime, and he was sitting on it. If he moved, the joints of the dainty thing twisted and squeaked, like it could come apart at any moment. He kept his boots firmly planted on either side, his weight on his toes, just in case. Lucas flipped a page, pretending to read. It wasn't that he didn't want to be reading. He just didn't want to be reading this. Entire shelves of more interesting work seemed to mock him from within their tin boxes. They sang out to be perused, for him to put away the order, with its rigid writing, bulleted lists, an internal labyrinth of page references that led in more circles than the great stairwell itself. Each entry in the order pointed to another page. Every page, another entry. Lucas flipped through a few and wondered if Bernard was keeping tabs on him. The head of IT sat on the other side of the small study, just one room of many in the well-stocked hideaway beneath the servers. While Lucas pretended to shadow for his new job, Bernard alternated between fiddling with the small computer on the other desk and going over to the radio mounted on the wall to give instructions to the security forces in the down deep. Lucas pinched a thick chunk of the order and flopped it to the side. He skipped past all the recipes for averting silo disasters and checked out some of the more academic reference material toward the back. This stuff was even more frightening. Chapters on group persuasion, on mind control, on the effects of fear on upbringing, graphs and tables dealing with population growth. He couldn't take it. He adjusted his chair and watched Bernard for a while as the head of IT and acting mayor scrolled through screen after screen of text, his head notching back and forth as he scanned the words there. After a moment, Lucas dared to break the silence.
Hey, Bernard?
Huh?
Hey, why isn't there anything in here about how all this came to be?
Bernard's office chair squealed as he swiveled it around to face Lucas.
I'm sorry, what?
The people who made all this, the people who wrote these books, why isn't there anything in the order about them? Like, how they built all this stuff in the first place?
Why would there be?
Bernard half turned back to his computer. So we would know? I don't know, like all the stuff in the other books.
I don't want you reading those other books. Not yet.
Bernard pointed to the wooden desk.
Learn the order first. If you can't keep the silo together, the legacy books are pulp. They're as good as processed wood, if no one's around to read them.
Nobody can read them but the two of us if they stay locked up down here.
No one alive. Not today. But one day there'll be plenty of people who'll read them. But only if you study.
Bernard nodded toward the thick and dreadful book before turning back to his keyboard and reaching for his mouse. Lucas sat there a while, staring at Bernard's back, the knotted cord of his master keys sticking out of the top of his undershirt.
I figure they must have known it was coming, Lucas said, unable to stop himself from perseverating about it. He had always wondered about these things, had suppressed them, had found his thrills in piecing together the distant stars that were so far away as to be immune to the hillside taboos. And now he lived in this vacuum, this hollow of the silo no one knew about, where forbidden topics didn't dare tread, and he had access to a man who seemed to know the precious truth.
You aren't studying, Bernard said.
His head remained bent over his keyboard, but he seemed to know Lucas was watching him.
But they had to have seen it coming, right?
Lucas lifted his chair and turned it around a little more.
I mean, to have built all these silos before it got so bad out there?
Bernard turned his head to the side, his jaw clenching and unclenching. His hand fell away from the mouse and came up to smooth his mustache.
These are the things you want to know? How it happened?
Yes, Lucas nodded. He leaned forward, elbows on his knees. I want to know.
Do you think it matters what happened out there?
Bernard turned and looked up at the schematics on the wall, then at Lucas.
Why would it matter?
Because it happened. And it only happened one way, and it kills me not to know. I mean, they saw it coming, right? It would take years to build all...
Decades,
Bernard said. And then move all this stuff in, all the people?
That took much less time.
So you know. Bernard nodded.
The information is stored here, but not in any of the books. And you're wrong. It doesn't matter. That's the past, and the past is not the same thing as our legacy. You'll need to learn the difference.
The difference between our past and our legacy?
Huh.
Bernard nodded. He seemed to be waiting on something. Lucas thought about the difference. For some reason, a conversation with Juliet sprang to his mind, something she was forever telling him.
Well, I think I know, he said.
Oh?
Bernard pushed his glasses up his nose and stared at him.
Tell me what you think you know.
All our hope, the accomplishments of those before us, what the world can be like, that's our legacy. Bernard's lips broke into a smile. He waved his hand to continue. And the bad things that can't be stopped, the mistakes that got us here, that's the past.
And what does this difference mean? What do you think it means?
It means we can't change what's already happened, but we can have an impact on what happens next. Bernard clapped his small hands together.
Very good.
And this? Lucas turned and rested his hand on the thick book. He continued, unbidden. The order? This is a roadmap for how to get through all the bad that's piled up between our past and the future's hope. This is the stuff we can prevent, that we can fix. Bernard raised his eyebrows at this last, as if it were a new way of looking at an old truth. Finally he smiled, his mustache curling up, his glasses rising on the wrinkled bridge of his nose.
I think you're almost ready, he said. Soon.
Bernard turned back to his computer, his hand falling to his mouse.
Very soon.
12. Silo 17. The descent to mechanical was oddly tranquil, almost mesmerizing. Juliet slid through the green flood, fending herself off the curved railing each time the staircase spiraled around beneath her feet. The only sounds anywhere were the hiss of air entering her helmet and the excess gurgling out the other side. A never-ending stream of bubbles rolled up her visor like beads of solder, drifting up in defiance of gravity. Juliet watched these silver spheres chase one another and play, like children through the metal stairs. They broke up where they touched the railing, leaving just minuscule dots of gas stuck to the surface, rolling and colliding. Others marched in wavy lines inside the stairway. They gathered in crowds beneath the hollow steps, bubbles becoming pockets of air that wobbled and caught the light radiating from the top of her helmet. It was easy to forget where she was, what she was doing. The familiar had become distorted and strange. Everything seemed magnified by the plastic dome of her visor, and it was easy to imagine that she wasn't sinking at all, but that the great stairway was rising, pushing up through the deep earth and heading toward the clouds. Even the sensation of the rope sliding through her gloved hands and across her padded belly felt more like something tugged inexorably from above, rather than a line she was descending. It wasn't until she arched her back and looked straight up that Juliet remembered how much water was stacking up above her. The green glow of the emergency lights faded to an eerie black in the space of a landing or two. The light from her flashlight barely dented it. Juliet inhaled sharply and reminded herself that she had all the air in the silo. She tried to ignore the sensation of so much liquid piled up on her shoulders,
of being buried alive. If she had to, if she panicked, she could just cut the weights free. One flick with the chef's knife and she would bob right back to the surface. She told herself this as she continued to sink. Letting go of the rope with one hand, she padded for the knife, making sure it was still there.
Slower!
Her radio barked. Juliet grabbed the rope with both hands and squeezed until she came to a stop. She reminded herself that Solo was up there, watching the air hose and electrical wires as they spooled off their neat coils. She imagined him tangled up in the lines, hopping around on one foot. Bubbles raced out of her overflow valve and jiggled through the lime water back toward the surface. She leaned her head back and watched them swirl around that taut rope, wondering what was taking him so long. In the undersides of the helical steps, the air pockets danced mercury silver, wavering in the turbulence of her passing.
Okay.
The radio speaker behind her neck crackled.
Get here.
Juliet cringed from the volume of Solo's voice and wished she'd checked that before closing up her helmet. There was no fixing it now. With ears ringing and the silence and majesty of the tranquil descent broken, she slid down another level, keeping her pace steady and slow as she studied the slack in the wire and the air hose for any sign of their pulling taut. As she passed close to the landing of 139, she saw that one of the doors was missing. The other door had been wrenched violently on its hinges. The entire level must be flooded, which meant more water for the pumps to move. Just before the landing rose out of sight, she saw dark forms down the corridor, shadows floating in the water. The flashlight on her helmet barely illuminated a pale and bloated face before she drifted past, leaving the long dead to rise out of sight. It hadn't occurred to Juliet that she might come across more bodies. Not the drowned, of course. The flood would have risen too slowly to take anyone by surprise. But any violence that occurred in the down deep would now be preserved in its icy depths. The chill of the water around her seemed to finally penetrate the layers of her suit. Or perhaps it was just her imagination. Her boots thumped to the lowermost floor of the stairwell while she was still looking up, keeping an eye on the slack in the lines. Her knees were jarred by the startling end to her descent. It had taken her far less time than a dry hike would have. With a grip on the rope for balance, Juliet let go with her other hand and waved it through the thick atmosphere of green groundwater. She dipped her chin against the radio switch.
"I'm down,"
she transmitted to Solo. She took a few lumbering and tentative steps, waving her arms and half-swimming toward the entrance to mechanical. The light from the stairwell barely penetrated past the security gates. Beyond, the oily depths of a home both foreign and familiar awaited her.
"I hear you,"
Solo answered after some delay. Juliet felt her muscles tense up as his voice rattled around inside her helmet. Not being able to adjust the volume was going to drive her mad. After a dozen halting steps, she eventually got the hang of the awkward wading motion and learned to drag her weighted boots across the steel decking. With the suit inflated and her arms and legs brushing around on the inside, it was like guiding a bubble by throwing oneself against its skin. She paused once to look back at the air hose, making sure it wasn't getting caught on the stairs, and she gave the rope she had descended one last glance. Even from this distance, it appeared as an impossibly slender thread, a thread hanging in that submerged straw of a stairwell. It wavered slightly in the wake she was causing, almost as if saying goodbye. Juliet tried not to read anything into it. She turned back to the entrance to mechanical. "You don't have to do this," she reminded herself.
She could hook up 2, maybe 3 more small pumps, plus a few additional runs of hydroponic piping. The work might take a few months. The water level would recede for years, but eventually those levels would be dry, and she could investigate those buried diggers Solo had told her about. It could be done with minimal risk, other than to her sanity. And if her only reason for getting back home was vengeance, if that was her only motivation, she might have chosen to wait, to take that safe route. She could feel the temptation even then to yank the weights off her boots and float up through the stairwell, to fly past the levels like she used to dream she could, arms out, buoyant and free. But Lucas had kept her apprised of the horrible mess her friends were in, the mess her leaving had caused. There was a radio mounted to his wall below the servers that leaked violence day and night. Solo's underground apartment was equipped with an identical radio, but it could only communicate with Silo 17's portables. Juliet had given up fiddling with it. A part of her was glad she couldn't hear. She didn't want to have to listen to the fighting. She just wanted to get home and make it stop. This had become a desperate compulsion, returning to her silo. It was maddening to think that she was only a short walk away, but those doors were only ever open to kill people. And what good would her return do anyway? Would her surviving a cleaning and revealing the truth be enough to expose Bernard and all of IT? As it happened, she had other, less sane plans. It was a fantasy, maybe, but it gave her hope. She dreamed of fixing up one of the diggers that built this place, a machine buried and hidden at the long end of its vertical toil, and driving it through the earth itself to 18s down deep. She dreamed of breaking that blockade, of leading her people back to these dry corridors, and getting this dead place working again. She dreamed of operating a silo without all the lies and deceptions. Juliet waded through the heavy water toward the security gate, dreaming these childish dreams, discovering that they somehow steeled her resolve. She approached the security turnstile and saw that the lifeless and unguarded gate would pose the first true obstacle of her descent. Getting over it wouldn't be easy. Turning her back to the machine, she placed her hands on either side and pushed, squirming and kicking her heavy heels against the low wall until she was just barely sitting on the control box. Her legs were too heavy to lift, not high enough to swing over, anyway. The weights had ended up being more than she'd needed to counter the suit's buoyancy. She wiggled backwards until her butt was more secure and tried to turn sideways. With a thick glove under her knee, she strained and leaned back until her boot was on the edge of the wall. She rested a moment, breathing hard and filling her helmet with muffled laughter. It felt ridiculous, all this effort to do something so outrageously simple, so benign. With one boot already up, the other was easier to lift. She felt the muscles in her abdomen and thighs, muscles sore from weeks of a porter's hustle, finally help her lift her own damn foot up. She shook her head in relief, sweat trickling down the back of her neck, already dreading repeating the maneuver on the return trip. Dropping to the other side was easy. The weights did all the work. She took a moment to make sure the wires knotted around her wrist and the air hose attached to her collar weren't getting tangled, and then started down the main corridor, the flashlight on the top of her helmet, her only illumination.
"You okay?"
Solo asked, his voice startling her again.
"I'm fine."
She held her chin down against her chest, leaving the contact open.
"I'll check in if I need you. The volume is a little high down here. It scares the hell out of me."
She released the contact and turned to see how her lifeline was doing. All along the ceiling, her overflow bubbles danced in the glow of her flashlight like tiny jewels.
Okay, gotcha.
God damn it, she muttered, wishing she could reach inside her helmet to adjust the thing or to dig a finger in her ear. It felt like his voice was still lodged in there, tickling her. With her boots hardly leaving the floor, pushing forward on them one at a time, she slowly made her way across the main intersection and past the mess hall. To her left, if she made her way down the hallway and took two turns, she could reach Walker's workshop. Had it always been a workshop? She had no idea. In this place, it might be a storeroom. Or an apartment. Her small apartment would be in the opposite direction. She turned to peer down that hallway, her cone of light brushing away the darkness to reveal a body pressed up against the ceiling, tangled in the runs of pipe and conduit. She looked away. It was easy to imagine that being George, or Scotty, or someone else she cared about and lost. It was easy to imagine it being herself. She shuffled toward the access stairs, her body wavering in the thick but crystal-clear water, the weight of her boots and the buoyancy of her torso keeping her upright, even though she felt on the verge of toppling. She paused at the top of the square steps leading down.
I'm about to descend, she said, chin down. Make sure you keep everything feeding, and please don't respond unless there's a problem. My ears are still ringing for the last time.
Juliet lifted her chin from the contact switch and took the first few steps, waiting for Solo to blare something in her ear, but it never came. She kept a firm grip on the wire and hose, dragging it around the sharp corners of the square stairwell as she descended into the darkness. The black water all around was disturbed only by her rising bubbles and the feeble cone of her sweeping, flashlit gaze. 6 floors down, the hose and wire became difficult to pull, too much friction from the steps. She stopped and gathered more and more of it around herself, letting the slack coil and drift in the weightlessness of the water. Several of her careful splices in both the wire and tubing slid through her gloves. She paused and checked the taped and adhesed joints of the ladder to see how they were holding up. Minuscule bubbles were trailing out of one joint. They left a perforated and wavy line of tiny dots in the dark water. It was hardly anything. Once she had enough slack at the bottom of the stairs to reach the sump basin, she turned and marched purposefully toward her work. The hardest part was over. The air was flowing in, cool and fresh and hissing by her ear. The excess streamed out through the other valve, the bubbles shooting up in a curtain whenever she turned her head. She had enough wire and hose to reach her goal, and all of her tools intact. It felt like she could finally relax now that she knew she wouldn't be going any deeper. All she had to do was hook up the power lines, two easy connections, and make her way out. Being so close, she dared to think of getting free, of rescuing this silo's mechanical spaces, resuscitating one of its generators and then one of its hidden and buried diggers. They were making progress. She was on her way to rescuing her friends. It all seemed perfectly attainable, practically in her grasp after weeks of frustrating setbacks. Juliet found the sump room just where it was supposed to be. She slid her boots to the edge of the pit in the center. Leaning forward, her flashlight shone down on the number signifying how deep the waters had risen. They seemed comical under so many hundreds of feet of water. Comical and sad. This silo had failed its people. But then Juliet corrected herself. These people had failed their silo.
Solo, I'm at the pump. Gonna hook up the power.
She peered down at the bottom of the pit to make sure the pump's pickup was clear of debris. The water down there was amazingly clear. All the oil and grime she'd worked hip-deep in at the bottom of her own basin had been made diffuse, spread out into who knew how many gallons of groundwater seepage. The result was crystal-clear stuff she could probably drink. She shivered, suddenly aware that the chill of the deep water was making its way through her layers and wicking away her body heat. "Halfway there," she told herself. She moved toward the massive pump mounted on the wall. Pipes as thick as her waist bent to the ground and snaked over the edge of the pit. The overflow ran up the wall in a similarly sized pipe and joined the jumble of mechanical runs above. As she stood by the large pump and worked the knotted wires off her wrist, she remembered the last job she'd ever performed as a mechanic. She had pulled the shaft on an identical pump and had discovered a worn and broken impeller. As she selected a Phillips driver from her pocket and began loosening the positive power terminal, she took the time to pray that this pump had not been in a similar condition when the power had blown. She didn't want to have to come down and service it again. Not until she could do it while keeping her boots dry. The positive power line came free easier than she had hoped. Juliet twisted the new one into place. The sound of her own breathing rattled in the confines of her helmet and provided her only company. As she was tightening the terminal around the new wire, she realized she could hear her breathing because the air was no longer hissing by her cheek. Juliet froze. She tapped the plastic dome by her ear and saw that the overflow bubbles were still leaking out, but slower now. The pressure was still inside her suit. There just wasn't any more air being forced inside. She dipped her chin against the switch, could feel the sweat form around her collar and drip down the side of her jaw. Her feet were somehow freezing, while from the neck up she was beginning to sweat.
"Solo, this is Juliet. Can you hear me? What's going on up there?"
She waited, turned to aim her flashlight down the air hose and looked for any sign of a kink. She still had air, the air in her suit. Why wasn't he responding?
"Hello, Solo, please say something."
The flashlight on her helmet needed to be adjusted, but she could feel the ticking of some silent clock in her head. How much air would she have starting right then? It had probably taken her an hour to get down there. Solo would fix the compressor before her air ran out. She had plenty of time. Maybe he was gassing it up. Plenty of time, she told herself, as the driver slipped off the negative terminal. The damn thing was stuck. This she didn't have time for, not for anything to be corroded. The positive wire was already spliced and locked tight. She tried to adjust the flashlight strapped to her helmet. It was aimed too high. Good for walking, horrible for working. She was able to twist it a little and aim it at the large pump. The ground wire could be connected to any part of the main housing, right? She tried to remember. The entire case was the ground, wasn't it? Or was it? Why couldn't she remember? Why was it suddenly difficult to think? She straightened the end of the black wire and tried to give the loose copper strands a twist with her heavily padded fingers. She jabbed this bundle of raw copper into a cowling vent on the back, a piece of conducting metal that appeared connected to the rest of the pump. She twisted the wire around a small bolt, knocked the slack so it would hold, and tried to convince herself that this would work, that it would be enough to run the damn thing. Walker would know. Where the hell was he when she needed him? The radio by her neck squawked, a burst and pop of static, what sounded like part of her name in a faraway distance, a dead hiss, and then nothing. Juliet wavered in the dark, cold water. Her ears were ringing from the outburst. She dipped her chin to tell Solo to hold the radio away from his mouth, when she noticed through the glass window of her helmet's visor that there were no more bubbles spilling from the overflow valve and rising in that gentle curtain across her vision. The pressure in her suit was gone. A different sort of pressure quickly took its place. 13. Silo 18. Walker found himself shoved down the square stairs, past a crew of mechanics working to weld another set of steel plates across the narrow passage. He had most of the home-built radio in a spare parts tub, which he desperately clutched with two hands. He watched the electrical components rattle together as he jostled through the crowd of mechanics fleeing from the attack above. In front of him, Shirley carried the rest of the radio gear against her chest, the antenna wires trailing behind her. Walker skipped and danced on his old legs so he wouldn't get tangled up.
"Go, go, go!"
someone yelled. Everyone was pushing and shoving. The rattle of gunfire seemed to grow louder behind him, while a golden shower of fizzling sparks rained through the air and peppered Walker's face. He squinted and stormed through the glowing hail as a team of miners in striped coveralls fought their way up from the next landing with another large sheet of steel.
"This way!"
Shirley yelled, tugging him along. At the next level, she pulled him aside. His poor legs struggled to keep up with the running others. A duffel bag was dropped. A young man with a gun spun and hurried back for it.
"The generator room," Shirley told him, pointing.
There was already a stream of people moving through the double doors. Jenkins was there, managing the traffic. Some of those with rifles took up position near an oil pump, the counterweighted head sitting perfectly still like it had already succumbed to the looming battle.
"What is that?" Jenkins asked as they approached the door.
He jerked his chin at the bundle of wires in Shirley's arms.
"Is that—"
"The radio, sir,"
she nodded.
"Fat lot of good it does us now."
Jenkins waved two other people inside. Shirley and Walker pressed themselves out of the way.
"Sir,
get him inside," Jenkins barked, referring to Walker. "I don't need him getting in the way."
"But, sir, I think you're going to want to hear—"
"Come on, go!"
Jenkins yelled to the stragglers, bringing up the rear. He twirled his arm at the elbow for them to hurry. Only the mechanics who had traded their wrenches for guns remained. They formed up like they were used to this game, arms propped on railings, long steel barrels trained the same direction.
"In or out?"
Jenkins told Shirley, starting to close the door.
"Go," she told Walker, letting out a deep breath. "Let's get inside."
Walker numbly obeyed, thinking all the while of the parts and tools he should have grabbed, things a few levels overhead now that were lost to him, maybe for good.
"Hey, get these people out of the control room!"
Shirley ran across the generator room as soon as they were inside, wires trailing behind her, bits of rigid aluminum antenna bouncing across the floor.
"Out!"
A mixed group of mechanics and a few people wearing the yellow of supply sheepishly filed out of the small control room. They joined the others around a railing that cordoned off the mighty machine that dominated the cavernous facility and gave the room its name. At least the noise was tolerable. Shirley imagined all those people being stuck down here in the days when the roar of the rattling shaft and loose engine mounts could deafen a person.
"All of you, out of my control room!"
She waved the last few out. Shirley knew why Jenkins had sealed off this floor. The only power they had left was the literal kind. She waved the last man out of the small room studded with sensitive knobs, dials, and readouts, and immediately checked the fuel levels. Both tanks were topped up, so they had at least planned that properly. They would have a few weeks of power, if nothing else. She looked over all the other knobs and dials, the jumble of cords still held tightly against her chest.
"Where should I—"
Walker held his box out. The only flat surfaces in the room were covered with switches and the sorts of things one didn't want to bump. He seemed to understand that.
"On the floor, I guess?"
She set her load down and moved to shut the door. The people she'd hurried outside gazed longingly through the window at the few tall stools in the climate-controlled space. Shirley ignored them.
"Do we have everything? Is it all here?"
Walker pulled pieces of the radio out of the box, tisking his tongue at the twisted wires and jumbled components.
"Do we have power?"
he asked, holding up the plug of a transformer. Shirley laughed. "Walk, you do know where you are right now, right? Of course we have power." She took the cord and plugged it into one of the feeds on the main panel. "Do we have everything? Can we get it up and running again? Walk, we need to let Jenkins hear what we heard."
"I know."
He bobbed his head and sorted the gear, twisting some loose wires together as he went.
"We need to string that out."
He jerked his head at the tangled antenna in her arms. Shirley looked up. There were no rafters.
"Hang it from the railing out there," he told her. "Straight line. Make sure that end reaches back in here."
She moved toward the door, trailing the loops out behind her.
"Oh, and don't let the metal bits touch the railing,"
Walker called after her. Shirley recruited a few mechanics from her work shift to help out. Once they saw what needed doing, they took over, coordinating as a team to undo the knots while she went back to Walker. "It'll just be a minute," she told him, shutting the door behind her, the wire fitting easily between it and the padded jamb.
"I think we're good," he said.
He looked up at her, his eyes sagging, his hair a mess, sweat glistening in his white beard.
"Oh, shit,"
he said. He slapped his forehead.
"We don't have speakers."
Shirley felt her heart drop to hear Walker cuss, thinking they'd forgotten something crucial. "I'll wait here," she told him, running back out and to the earmuff station. She picked one of the sets with a dangling cord, the kind used to talk between the control room and anyone working on the primary or secondary generators. She jogged past the curious and frightened-looking crowd to the control room. It occurred to her that she should be more afraid like they were, that a real war was grinding closer to them, but all she could think about were the voices that war had interrupted. Her curiosity was much stronger than her fear. It's how she'd always been. "Well, how about these?" She shut the door behind herself and showed him the headphones.
"Perfect,"
he said, his eyes wide with surprise. Before she could complain, he snipped the jack off with his multi-tool and began stripping wires.
"Good thing it's quiet in here,"
he said, laughing. Shirley laughed as well, and it made her wonder what the hell was going on. What were they going to do? Sit in there and fiddle with wires while the deputies and the security people from IT came and dragged them away? Walker got the cones wired in, and a faint hiss of static leaked out of them. Shirley hurried over to join him. She sat down and held his wrist to steady his hand. The earphones trembled in them.
"You might have to,"
he showed her the knob with the white marks he'd painted on. Shirley nodded and realized they'd forgotten to grab the paint. She held the dial and studied the various ticks. "Which one?" she asked.
"No."
He stopped her as she began dialing back toward one of the voices they'd found.
"The other way. I need to see how many..."
He coughed into his fist.
"We need to see how many there are."
She nodded and turned the knob gradually toward the black, unpainted portion. The two of them held their breath, the hum of the main generator barely audible through the thick door and double-paned glass. Shirley studied Walker while she spun the dial. She wondered what would become of him when they were rounded up. Would they all be put to cleaning? Or could he and a few of the others claim to be bystanders? It made her sad, thinking what had been wrought of their anger, their thirst for revenge. She thought of how things could have gone so differently, how they'd had all these dreams, unrealistic, perhaps, of a real change in power, an easy fix to impossible and intractable problems.
"A little faster,"
Walker said, growing impatient with the silence. They'd heard a few hits of crackling static, but no one talking. Shirley very slightly increased the rate she spun the knob. You think the antenna? She started to ask. Walker raised his hand. The little speakers in his lap had popped. He jerked his thumb to the side, telling her to go back. Shirley did. She tried to remember about how far she had gone since the sound, using a lot of the same skills she'd learned in that very room to adjust the previously noisy generator.
Solo, this is Juliet. Can you hear me? What's going on up there?
Shirley dropped the knob. She watched it swing on its soldered wire and crash to the floor. Her hands felt numb. Her fingertips tingled. She turned, gaped at Walker's lap where the ghostly voice had risen, and found him looking dumbly down at his own hands. Neither of them moved. The voice, the name, they were unmistakable. Tears of confused joy winked past Walker's beard and fell into his lap. 14. Silo 17. Juliet grabbed the limp air hose with both hands and squeezed. Her reward was a few weak bubbles rolling up her visor. The pressure inside the tube was gone. She whispered a curse, tilted her chin against the radio, and called Solo's name. Something had happened to the compressor. He was probably working on it, maybe topping up the fuel. She told him not to turn it off for that. He wouldn't know what to do, wouldn't be able to restart it. She hadn't thought this through clearly at all. She was an impossible distance from breathable air, from any hope of survival. She took a tentative breath. She had what was trapped in the suit and the air that remained in the hose. How much of the air in the hose could she suck with just the power of her lungs? She didn't think it would be much, but she didn't know. She took one last look at the large sump pump, her hasty wiring job, the loose trail of wires streaming through the water that she'd hoped to have time to secure against vibration and accidental tugs. None of it likely mattered anymore, not for her. She kicked away from the pump and waved her arms through the water, wading through the viscous fluid that seemed to both impede her while giving her nothing to push or pull against. The weights were holding her back. Juliet bent to release them and found she couldn't. The buoyancy of her arms, the stiffness of the suit, she groped for the Velcro straps, but watched her fingers through the magnified view of the helmet and water as they waved inches from the blasted things. She took a deep breath, sweat dripping from her nose and splattering the inside of her dome. She tried again and came close, her fingertips nearly brushing the black straps, both hands outstretched, grunting and throwing her shoulders into the simple act of reaching her damned shins. But she couldn't. She gave up and shuffled a few more steps down the hallway, following the wire and hose, both visible in the faint cone of white light emanating from above her head. She tried not to bump the wire, thinking of what one accidental pull might do, how tenuous the connection was that she'd made to the pump's ground. Even as she struggled for a deep breath, her mind was ever playing the mechanic. She cursed herself for not taking longer to prepare. Her knife! She remembered her knife and stopped dragging her feet. It slid out of its homemade sheath sewn across her belly and gleamed in the glow from her flashlight. Juliet bent down and used the extra reach of the blade. She slid the point of the knife between her suit and one of the straps. The water was dark and thick all around her. With the limited amount of light from her helmet, and being at the bottom of mechanical under all that heap of flood, she felt more remote and alone, more afraid than she had in all her life. She gripped the knife, terrified of what dropping it could mean, and bobbed up and down, using her stomach muscles. It was like doing sit-ups while standing. She attacked the strap with a labored sawing motion, cursed in her helmet from the effort, the strain, the pain in her abdomen from lurching forward, from throwing her head down, when finally the exercise weight popped free.
Her calf felt suddenly naked and light as the round hunk of iron clanged mutely to the plate steel flooring. Juliet tilted to the side, held down by one leg, the other trying to rise up. She worked the knife carefully beneath the second strap, fearful of cutting her suit and seeing a stream of precious bubbles leak out. With desperate force, she shoved and pulled the blade against the black webbing, just like before. Nylon threads popped in her magnified vision, sweat spattered her helmet, the knife burst through the fabric, the weight was free. Juliet screamed as her boots flew up behind her, rising above her head. She twisted her torso and waved her arms as much as she could, but her helmet slammed into the runs of pipes at the top of the hallway. There was a bang, and the water all around her went black. She fumbled for her flashlight to turn it back on, but it wasn't there. Something bumped her arm in the darkness. She fumbled for the object with one hand, knife in the other, felt it spill through her gloved fingers, and then it was gone. While she struggled to put the knife away, her only source of light tumbled, invisible, to the ground below. Juliet heard nothing but her rapid breathing. She was going to die like this, pinned to the ceiling, another bloated body in these corridors. It was as if she were destined to perish in one of these suits, one way or another. She kicked against the pipes and tried to wiggle free. Which way had she been going? Where was she facing? The pitch black was absolute. She couldn't even see her own arms in front of her. It was worse than being blind. It was some new ability to see the nothingness, to know her eyes were working but somehow taking nothing in. It heightened her panic, even as the air in her suit seemed to grow more and more stale. The air. She reached for her collar and found the hose, could just barely feel it through her gloves. Juliet began to gather it in, hand over hand, like pulling a mining bucket up a deep shaft. It felt like miles of it went through her hands. The slack gathered around her like knotted noodles, bumping and sliding against her. Juliet's breathing began to sound more and more desperate. She was panicking. How much of her shallow breathing was coming from the adrenaline, the fear? How much because she was using up all her precious air? She had a sudden terror that the hose she was pulling had been cut, that it had been sawn through on the stairwell, that the free end would at any moment slip through her fingers, that her next frantic reach for more of the lifeline would result in a fistful of inky water and nothing else. But then she grabbed a length of hose with tension, with life, a stiff line that held no air but led the way out. Juliet cried out in her helmet and reached forward to grab another handhold. She pulled herself, her helmet bumping against a pipe and bouncing her away from the ceiling. She kept reaching, lunging one hand forward in the black to where the line should be, finding it, grasping, yanking, hauling herself through the midnight soup of the drowned and the dead, wondering how far she'd get before she joined them and breathed her very last. 15. Silo 18. Lucas sat with his mother on the thick jamb of the open server room door. He looked down at her hands, both of them wrapped around one of his. She let go with one of them and picked a piece of lint off his shoulder, then cast the offending knot of string away from her precious son.
"And you say there'll be a promotion in this?"
she asked, smoothing the shoulder of his undershirt. Lucas nodded.
"A pretty big one, yeah."
He looked past her to where Bernard and Sheriff Billings were standing in the hallway, talking in low voices. Bernard had his hands tucked inside the stretched belly of his coveralls. Billings looked down and inspected his gun.
"Well, that's great, sweetheart. It makes it easier to bear you being away."
"It won't be for much longer, I don't think."
"Will you be able to vote? I can't believe my boy is doing such important things."
Lucas turned to her.
"Vote? I thought the election was put off."
She shook her head. Her face seemed more wrinkled than it had a month ago, her hair whiter. Lucas wondered if that were possible in so brief a time.
"Oh, it's back on,"
she said.
"This nasty business with those rebels is supposed to be just about over."
Lucas glanced toward Bernard and the sheriff.
"I'm sure they'll figure out a way to let me vote," he told his mother.
"Well, that's nice. I like to think I raised you proper."
She cleared her throat into her fist, then returned it to the back of his hand.
"And they're feeding you? With the rationing, I mean?"
"Oh, more than I can eat."
Her eyes widened.
"So I suppose there'll be some sort of a raise?"
He shrugged. "I'm not sure. I'd think so. And look, you'll be taken care of."
"Me?"
She pressed her hand to her chest, her voice high.
"Oh, don't you worry about me."
"You know I do. Hey, look, Ma, I think our time's up."
He nodded down the hallway. Bernard and Peter were heading toward them.
"It looks like I've got to get back to work."
"Oh, well, of course."
She smoothed the front of her red coveralls and allowed Lucas to help her get to her feet. She puckered her lips and he presented his cheek.
"My little boy."
She said, kissing him noisily and squeezing his arm. She stepped back and gazed up at him with pride.
"You take good care of yourself."
"I will, Ma."
"Make sure you get plenty of exercise."
"Ma, I will."
Bernard stopped by their side, smiling at the exchange. Lucas's mother turned and looked the silo's acting mayor up and down. She reached out and patted Bernard on his chest.
"Thank you,"
she said, her voice cracking.
"Oh, it's been great to meet you, Mrs. Kyle."
Bernard took her hand and gestured toward Peter.
"The sheriff here will see you out."
"Oh, of course."
She turned one last time and waved at Lucas. He felt a little embarrassed, but waved back.
"Sweet lady,"
Bernard said, watching them go.
"She reminds me of my mother."
He turned to Lucas.
"Are you ready?"
Lucas felt like voicing his reluctance, his hesitation. He felt like saying, "I suppose." But he straightened his back instead, rubbed his damp palms together and dipped his chin.
"Absolutely," he managed, feigning a confidence he didn't feel.
"Great. Let's go make this official."
He squeezed Lucas's shoulder before heading into the server room. Lucas walked around the edge of the thick door and leaned into it, slowly sealing himself in as the fat hinges groaned shut. The electric locks engaged automatically, thumping into the jam. The security panel beeped, its happy green light flicking over to the menacing red eye of a sentry. Lucas took a deep breath and picked his way through the servers. He tried not to go the same way as Bernard, tried never to go the same way twice. He chose a longer route just to break the monotony, to have one less routine in that prison. Bernard had the back of the server open by the time he arrived. He held the familiar headphones out to Lucas. Lucas accepted them and put them on backwards, the microphone snaking around the rear of his neck.
Like this?
Bernard laughed at him and twirled his finger.
"Other way around,"
he said, lifting his voice so Lucas could hear through the muffs. Lucas fumbled with the headphones, tangling his arm in the cord. Bernard waited patiently.
"Are you ready?"
Bernard asked, once they were in place. He held the loose jack in one hand. Lucas nodded. He watched Bernard turn and aim the plug at the banks of receptacles. He pictured Bernard's hand swinging down and to the right, slamming the plug home into number 17, then turning and confronting Lucas about his favorite pastime, his secret crush. But his boss's small hand never wavered. It clicked into place. Lucas, knowing exactly how that felt, how the receptacle hugged the plug tightly, seemed to welcome it in, the pads of one's fingers getting a jolt from the flicking of that spring-loaded plastic retainer. The light above the jack started blinking. A familiar buzzing throbbed in Lucas's ears. He waited for her voice, for Juliet to answer. A click.
Name.
A trail of fear ran up Lucas's back, bumps erupting across his arms. The voice, deep and hollow, impatient and aloof, came and went like the glimpse of a star. Lucas licked his lips.
Lucas Kyle, he said, trying not to stammer.
There was a pause. He imagined someone, somewhere, writing this down or flipping through files or doing something awful with the information. The temperature behind the server soared. Bernard was smiling at him, oblivious to the silence on his end.
You shadowed in IT.
It felt like a statement, but Lucas nodded and answered. Yes, sir. He wiped his palm across his forehead and then the seat of his coveralls. He desperately wanted to sit down, to lean back against server number 40, to relax, but Bernard was smiling at him, his mustache lifting, his eyes wide behind his glasses.
What is your primary duty to the silo?
Bernard had prepped him on likely questions.
To maintain the order?
Silence. No feedback. No sense if he was right or wrong.
What do you protect above all?
The voice was flat, and yet powerfully serious. Dire and somehow calm. Lucas felt his mouth go dry. Life and legacy, he recited. But it felt wrong, this rote facade of knowledge. He wanted to go into detail, to let this voice, like a strong and sober father, understand that he knew why this was important. He wasn't dumb. He had more to say than memorized facts.
What does it take to protect these things we hold so dear?
He paused.
It takes sacrifice, Lucas whispered.
He thought of Juliet, and the calm demeanor he was projecting for Bernard nearly crumbled. There were some things he wasn't sure about, things he didn't understand. This was one of them. It felt like a lie, his answer. He wasn't sure the sacrifice was worth it, the danger so great that they had to let people, good people, go to their...
How much time have you had in the suit labs?
The voice had changed, relaxed somewhat. Lucas wondered if the ceremony was over. Was that it? Had he passed? He blew out his held breath, hoping the microphone didn't pick it up, and tried to relax.
Not much, sir. Bernard, my boss, he's wanting me to schedule time in the labs after, you know...
He looked to Bernard, who was pinching one side of his glasses and watching him.
Yes, I do know. How is that problem in your lower levels going?
Well, I'm only kept apprised of the overall progress, and it sounds good.
He cleared his throat and thought of all the sounds of gunfire and violence he'd heard through the radio in the room below.
That is, it sounds like progress is being made, that it won't be much longer.
A long pause. Lucas forced himself to breathe deeply, to smile at Bernard.
Would you have done anything differently, Lucas, from the beginning?
Lucas felt his body sway, his knees go a little numb. He was back on that conference table, black steel pressed against his cheek, a line from his eye extending through a small cross, through a tiny hole, pointing like a laser at a small woman with gray hair and a bomb in her hand. Bullets were flying down that line. His bullets.
No, sir, he finally said. It was all by the order, sir. Everything's under control.
He waited. Somewhere, he felt, his measure was being taken.
You are next in line for the control and operation of Silo 18, the voice intoned.
Thank you, sir.
Lucas reached for the headphones, was preparing to take them off and hand them to Bernard in case he needed to say something, to hear that it was official.
"Do you know the worst part of my job?"
the hollow voice asked. Lucas dropped his hands.
"What's that, sir?" "Standing here, looking at a silo on this map and drawing a red cross through it. Can you imagine what that feels like?"
Lucas shook his head. "I can't, sir."
"It feels like a parent losing thousands of children all at once."
A pause.
"You will have to be cruel to your children to not lose them."
Lucas thought of his father. "Yes, sir."
"Welcome to Operation 50 of the World Order, Lucas Kyle. Now, if you have a question or two, I have the time to answer, but briefly."
Lucas wanted to say that he had no questions. He wanted to get off the line. He wanted to call and speak with Juliet, to feel a puff of sanity breathed into this crazy and suffocating room. But he remembered what Bernard had taught him about admitting ignorance, how this was the key to knowledge.
Just one, sir. And I've been told it isn't important, and I understand why that's true, but I believe it will make my job here easier if I know."
He paused for a response, but the voice seemed to be waiting for him to get to the question. Lucas cleared his throat.
"Is there?"
He pinched the mic and moved it closer to his lips, glanced at Bernard.
"How did all this begin?"
He wasn't sure. It could have been a fan on the server whirring to life, but he thought he heard the man with the